Hey, everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Facts and Fallacies, episode 218. My name is Cameron English. I am your host, as always, joined again by Dr. Liza Dunn, while Kevin is off being a dad. How are you, Liza? Good to see you again.
I'm great. It's been a busy week. I can't believe we're already back to Friday.
Yes, yes. TGIF, it's a cliche, but it's totally true. And by the way, happy Mother's Day to all you mothers out there. That holiday just passed us by. I hope you had a great one with your kids and your families. And let's talk about some science to get back to our the point of us being here.
Okay. Sounds good.
So we've got three stories, as always. The first one is, here's the wacky formula used by Environmental Working Group to stoke unwarranted fears about safe chemicals. Next up, precision medicine and pharmacogenetics. Here's why certain drugs work better for some people than others. And finally, social media amplifies misinformation. No, modern pesticides are not the driver of insect declines, and no, they are not poisoning us. All right, so these are right up our alley, I should say, especially because we've got a toxicologist hanging out for the next few weeks. So we've got a lot of cool stuff to get in here. But let me introduce this first story, and let me just say full disclosure: this story is by Dr. Chuck Dinnerstein at the American Council on Science and Health. I host another podcast with him called Science Dispatch, which you can get everywhere podcasts are available. So I am biased here. I'm a big fan of his work, and I work with him. So keep that in mind. But in any case, I like Chuck's approach to writing because he's a retired surgeon. So he goes into these stories, and he lays out all the details, and he explains how they're related to each other, why one might be more important than the other. And then you get to the end, and he drops the conclusion. You go, oh, that makes perfect sense, right? So this is a very helpful approach to these stories. So here he's talking about a study that was conducted by our friends at the Environmental Working Group, authors of the Dirty Dozen list that comes out every spring. And here they're talking about exposure to a chemical called PFAS. And this is one of the so-called forever chemicals you've heard about for ages now. But they're looking at exposure to this chemical through consumption of freshwater fish. And the reason they're doing this study is because for decades, there's been concern that consuming foods that contain this chemical or just environmental exposure in general could cause high cholesterol, it could cause liver cancer, it could cause a poor vaccine response in young children. So this is a whole class of chemicals. PFAS is the big broad class, and Liza can talk much more about this. She's the expert on this. But this is the reason for the study, and as we're going to explain, I think there's some real limitations here, and I think their reason for the study isn't justified. But what they did here is they looked at the quantity of this chemical in a given species of freshwater fish, and then they multiplied that number by the number of fish Americans in various studies reported consuming. And based on that, they said your blood level of PFAS is this number. Now, we'll get into why that methodology is somewhat shaky in a minute, but here's their conclusion. They say exposure to chemical pollutants in freshwater fish across the U.S. is a case of environmental injustice that especially affects communities that depend on fishing for sustenance and for traditional cultural practices. Identifying and reducing sources of PFAS, that broader class we're talking about, exposure is an urgent public health priority. Okay, so there's a quick rundown of the study. Again, Liza, you're the toxicologist. The EPA trusts you to talk about this stuff. So explain your thoughts on this.
So basically, what is this chemical, and why is it around? Why was it important in any way? So basically, it's a group of different chemicals that are very, very resistant to heat and cold temperatures, and it was used. It's used in managing fires, so putting out fires, and also on nonstick plates and or pans, cooking utensils and things like that. And so it's very, very useful, and it's been around for a very long time. And because it's been around for a very long time, and it is resistant to these things, it also tends to stick around. So it's one of these things that people call forever chemicals. Now, that said, you're only finding very, very, very slight trace amounts of this chemical around, or this class of chemical around. And I think that they're very important when you're talking about preventing fires and things in your house. So, you know, you want to have kids had flame retardants in their pajamas, and you wound up having flame retardants in your furniture, because fires can really, really cause a significant amount of damage. I think about 3,000 people die a year in the United States from big house fires. So the reason why these chemicals were developed was to actually be protective in those kinds of cases. And because they were used in so many flame retardants and things like that, you tend to find them sticking around. Recently, there's been increasing concern about chemicals sticking around. And that is, in my opinion, more because people are just scared of the concept of having a chemical and being exposed to a chemical rather than a very well established health effect. So these aren't like, you know, cigarettes, where if you're smoking, you're inhaling, you know, large numbers of carcinogens and carbon monoxide and things like that. These are chemicals that were developed to protect kids from fires, and trace exposures are generally not going to have a health effect. And so the EPA, when they're trying to decide on a cutoff in water, what the acceptable level of exposure is, what they do is they take the health effect that has the most sensitive health effect that they can find at the lowest exposure, and they make that their baseline health advisory number, right? So for what there is in epidemiologic studies, there's an association, but not necessarily a causal relationship in kids where kids had levels of PFAS measured in their blood, and there was an association with them having a decreased antibody response to vaccination. And so EPA thought that's the number that we're going to use to try to decide whether or not, or to make a drinking water acceptable number. I hope that's clear how I explain that.
Yeah, very clear. And Susan Goldhaber, we discussed her work last week. She's also a toxicologist. She writes about this, and the EPA's advisory on this issue drives her nuts, because it's hyper cautious, and it's based on a relatively small sample size of children from an island in the Pacific somewhere. It's a very goofy standard. Not that they're not important, but when you're trying to set a standard for an entire population, that's a weird way to do it.
So and the cutoff is supposed to be protective of all other health effects, and so it's a very, very conservative number. Mm-hmm. It's funny because they had a higher cutoff in 2016, but because of this study, they've changed that number recently. Yeah. And we're talking about parts per trillion. It's tiny, 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 tiny trace amounts. So less than a drop in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Yeah. So very, very, no real established health effects, mm-hmm. no real established mechanism by which these substances cause a health effect. In some studies, there are some brand new neonatal mice, there's some thyroid effect in mothers who've been fed high doses, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe some liver kind of thing, but nothing that's going to be at the trace amounts that people are exposed to.
Yes, that's a very good point. And let me add, you mentioned a couple products that these chemicals are used in, but cell phones, tablets, telecommunication systems, aircraft for the U.S. military, solar panels, turbines, batteries, and all sorts of medical devices. So in other words, you almost certainly read about EWG study on a device that contains one of these chemicals, not necessarily PFOS, because exposure to that has dropped. We'll talk about that in a second. But this is one of the things that's always amusing to me, is that, you know, they're warning you about the dangers of chemicals using these chemicals. It's always kind of funny.
That's right. Okay,
so let's move on. There's a couple of things, and again, I really want your input here since you're the expert. So Dr. Dinnerstein points out they didn't actually measure serum levels or blood levels of PFOS in people. They built this little model that I described a minute ago. And that's funny to me, because they could have, and this would have been more expensive and time consuming, but they could have done some actual science, and they could have had an experimental group and a control group, or maybe the design would be a little bit different. But you take people that eat a certain amount of fish, and then you take people that eat no fish, and then you measure their serum levels of this chemical, and presumably that would give you more reliable results than what they did. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you don't have a biomarker and you are making claims that we need to do all sorts of expensive testing and expensive remediation at taxpayer expense, right? So huge amounts of, you know, remediation that's what they're calling for, but they have no clinical evidence that it causes any significant harm in people, and no even measurement that reliably says that these people were even exposed or had a level that was above what the EPA recommended or the EWG recommended. So if, you know, it's like saying, you know, you're exposed to something in your house and you need to take down the whole house instead of actually measuring into determining whether you're exposed to it. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what people don't realize when they're making these big recommendations, especially because these chemicals are regulated, right? And so these chemicals have been widely tested and they have been heavily regulated and things like that. So if you, based on an allegation without a confirmation and a wild extrapolation of a number, they're expecting EPA and other organizations to, you know, do a lot of testing that's really cost the taxpayers money.
Yeah, EWG is not going to foot the bill. A couple more things, and this was interesting to me, but apparently the pharmacokinetics of this particular chemical, and that's a $5 term for what the body does with the drug once you take it or once you're exposed to it. It's not clear, which is interesting. So in other words, as you said, you don't have a mechanism. It's not clear how this would cause harm. I thought that was really interesting. And then the CDC, you know, that famous industry think tank, they say most animal studies have tested doses of PFAS, so the overall class of chemical we're talking about here, at doses that are higher than the doses people experience from environmental exposure. Now, this is my own analysis here, but that would include from eating freshwater fish. So just as a baseline here, really important stuff to keep in mind. You're not getting, you know, loads of this chemical when you eat a piece of trout or something.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And most people, like this article pointed out, most people aren't eating the fish that are at the highest levels,
right?
So most people are eating commercially available fish, and they aren't fishing in freshwater streams for their own fish. Now, there are some subsistence fishers who rely on that food source, but even then, that those numbers are exaggerated for the people who are relying on fishing. So, you know, indigenous Alaskans often wind up fishing in streams and things like that, where there you find more of these chemicals. But they're not measuring those levels in those people. They're extrapolating, you know, what those levels may be, and without a measurement, you know, it's very difficult to say.
Yeah. And as we'll see in just a second, I think the reason they did this is because when you do a real study, you can't alert the media and freak everybody out. So let me see here. Let's go on to a couple of Chuck's other points. So he says, And this is a really interesting, and it's just a baseline point that you would think of. So he says, the assumption that no PFAS are removed through cooking is wrong. And this is an assumption that the study made. And he points to another piece of research that was published in Food Science and Nutrition Reports. And what they found is that how fish is prepared makes a big difference. So washing it alone removes 74% of the chemicals we're talking about. Cooking provided another reduction. Grilling dropped it to 91%, steaming 75%, frying 58%, and braising 47% compared to an uncooked sample. So basically, by the time you get done preparing this and cooking it, when it's on your plate, there's almost none of this chemical left, right? So in other words, for their study to even go forward, they had to assume, and they say this very clearly, they had to assume that the amount of PFAS in the fish when it's caught is the same when it shows up on your plate. And that's just demonstrably false.
Yep, that's exactly right. And once again, we're talking about parts per trillion, and right. You wind up cooking and you get even less than a parts per trillion. So yeah, it's negligible.
Yeah. And I want to try to share my screen here because Dr. Dinnerstein includes a very important graph, and it alludes to the point you just made, which is that most of the fish that people consume have very low levels of this. There were a few species that had higher levels, and when you average them out, it looks like a bigger number. So let me bring this up here and show you just visual aids are sometimes helpful. So here we go. Let's see. Okay. I can't share it. It's all right. Basically, the point is just what I said it is, which is that it looks like it's four or five species that have like slightly higher levels, but the vast majority have almost none. So that's a really important point.
And yeah, most people aren't eating carp that's been caught in a local pond.
Yes, absolutely. You know, a piece of trout or something is not going to make you keel over or give you heart disease. Okay, let's see. There is one other point in here that I wanted to make, and Dr. Dinnerstein makes this as well. The amount of the chemical in this in recent years has declined. So the data sets they're using, they're from EPA studies, they're from legitimate studies, but they're from 2015. So there's been a massive decline already, right? So from the outset of this study, they're using outdated numbers. And that's critical because they're almost certainly overestimating exposure like that. So as he puts it, it's an overestimation of an overestimation. And this is all clear if you read the paper, but it's not clear in the news reports. It's not clear in EWG's press release, right? The take home they want you to have is, this dangerous chemical is an environmental justice issue without any of these clarifying details.
Exactly. And that's the problem. I personally think that house fires are an environmental justice issue too, because of all of the, especially for kids, right? Yeah. You know, you get big fires and you wind up not having flame retardants and your house can go up in a nanosecond. So yes. I personally am in favor of minimizing the harm that comes from fires versus being terribly concerned about trace exposures of these chemicals.
Very good point. And by the way, if you're freaked out about chemicals, when wood burns, you'll never guess what it produces. Very, very dangerous chemicals. Yeah. I don't know the exact statistic, but a good percentage of the fire deaths you mentioned are from smoke inhalation because there's dangerous chemicals in burning wood, burns your lungs, causes all kinds of nasty effects and kills people.
There's dangerous chemicals in also burning foam, cyanide out of burning foam. So people in house fires die from cyanide poisoning often, which people don't know about it. So the reason why you don't want the foam to burn is because you don't want to have cyanide poisoning. So
yes. Yeah. So in other words, you need to do just a pretty simple risk assessment, right? Be afraid of chemicals. Sometimes you should be, but just look at all the chemicals. Don't look at the ones that the organic industry funded activist groups tell you to be afraid of, because a lot of the times they are, they're lying to you. Just a final point. This is also a really basic one, but 60% of freshwater fish is catch and release. In some places like where I'm at in California, there are laws that say, you know, during this part of the year, you can catch this many and you have to throw the rest back. Sometimes it's permanent depending on where you're fishing and what you're fishing for. So that of course further cuts the exposure because people are not eating everything they can.
Not actually.
Okay, let's move on and talk about precision medicine. This is actually a really cool story and a really positive one, which we don't always get to talk about. But this is by a journalist named Catherine Ho, writing for San Francisco Chronicle. The story is called Precision Medicine and Pharmacogenetics. Here's why certain drugs work better for some people than others. Now, the premise here is that prescription drugs affect people very differently, right? So when you go to the doctor, and again, Liza can speak to this with more detail, your age, your weight, past health conditions, other drugs you're taking, these can all influence the effects of a pharmaceutical that you're prescribed, or I guess even an over-the-counter drug too as well. So to try and get around this or improve the efficacy of some of these medicines, the University of California, San Francisco has launched a testing program to see if people with certain genes, or I guess certain mutations in those genes, do they respond differently to various medications? Because there's some evidence for so let's see the numbers here. So 15 genes that affect the body's response to 56 drugs. So they're trying to test this and see if they can say, you know, maybe you shouldn't take this one. It's not going to work for you. Take something else. It's sort of like what we were talking about last week with AI. I mean, I think maybe this is the other side of the coin. It's advances in genomics that are helping on the other side of this.
That's so, exactly right. It's like precision medicine. We talk about precision ag, right? And being able to tweak things in agriculture. Well, you can actually help determine which kinds of people would be more prone to a drug reaction, an adverse reaction, and maybe tailor your use of certain drugs to make sure that they don't have those adverse reactions or add things to them. And we can talk about that in a little minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And these are a range of drugs. This isn't like Tylenol or something. So these are cancer therapies, drugs for high cholesterol, statins primarily, pain medications, treatments for psychiatric disorders. So in other words, if you can target these better, these can treat very serious conditions. And in many cases, like cancer is very life-threatening. So as high cholesterol can be as well, and even psychiatric disorders. So this is an important development. So once this program gets underway, I believe it's only with a relative handful of patients that are in the UCSF system. But the idea is once they're enrolled in this program, their doctors will get notifications that say, hey, there might be what's called a gene-drug interaction. Based on the patient's condition and based on what you're likely to prescribe them, it's time to run some more tests to make sure that this is safe and it's going to be effective. And just a final wrap up here. So this was a study published in The Lancet. They found that, 7 hospitals in Europe observed a 30% reduction in adverse drug reactions using these same kind of testing methods. So this is really cool. Please jump in here and fill in the gaps for everybody.
Yeah, so this is really, really cool. You know, so about 100,000 deaths a year are attributed to adverse drug reactions. About 2 million people are hospitalized every year because of them. And 30% of those adverse drug reactions are thought to be able to be reduced by this, right? Mm-hmm. This particular testing. So what kind of testing is this really? So you're looking for people, for a long time, people have known that certain people wind up with extra levels of drug in their blood, and other people wind up not seeming to have enough levels of blood in their drug. So the way the drug is actually metabolized or broken down and the speed with which that happens can make it either more or less potent, right? So if you are a slow metabolizer, that drug will last longer in your system and have a biologic effect for a longer time. So if you are, you know, that might change your dosing regimen eventually. If you may need less drug over a longer time because it's sticking around in your bloodstream for a longer time because it's not getting broken down. So they can test for a gene to see if you're a slow metabolizer, right? And if you're a slow metabolizer, you might not need as much of that drug. Now, if you're a fast metabolizer and you break down that drug really, really quick, you've got a gene that is like, ooh, I like that drug and I'm going to break it all down really quick. You might need more of that drug, a higher dose, or you might need a shorter interval in between doses. So you have a biologically active form of the drug around for a longer time. Now, what's really interesting is that if you're on, you can have genes that actually make you a slow metabolizer for one drug and a fast metabolizer for another drug.
Yeah.
So you can specifically tailor your dosing regimen around of different drugs around those genes. And you can also predict what you know, which genes will make you more prone to drug-drug interactions that might be bad.
Mm-hmm.
So these are really important for things like isoniazid, which people take for tuberculosis, right? Mm-hmm. Tuberculosis is becoming, isoniazid is an antibiotic that was discovered in the 50s. It's one of the mainstays of TB treatment. And TB has become resistant to it over time. Now, so if you have a fast metabolizer who breaks it down really, really quickly, you might not have a high enough therapeutic dose to get to that TB for long enough, right? You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you might want to increase your dose a little bit. Now, you've got to be careful with dosing an isoniazid because if you have too high of a dose, you can wind up causing liver problems. And that is also based on metabolism too. You can get mm-hmm. some hepatitis and you can get what we call a peripheral neuropathy. So it interferes with a vitamin B6 or pyridoxine. And so you can have numbness and tingling or painful neuropathy that's almost like a diabetic neuropathy because of pyridoxine deficiency mm-hmm. in the arms and legs. So isoniazid, you might want to replete with pyridoxine. So it's a very interesting and very cool way of predicting how having a better, a more precise understanding of how a particular patient's going to respond to a particular dose of drugs.
And to my surprise, this is actually more, it's further along than I thought it was. So when you think about some of the gimmicky stuff. So like there's people that will sell you DNA-based diets and they will, you know, you spit in a tube and they say, well, you have, you know, 2745 ABX and that gene is associated with obesity. And so based on that, you need to eat less sugar. It's like, gee, thanks.
Thank you for paying me all this money yes. to tell you it shouldn't eat sugar.
Yes. Yeah. Very helpful. But in other words, the point is that there's a lot of research out there that correlates particular mutations in particular genes with conditions or outcomes that we're interested in. This is much different. And again, I'm looking at the CDC's website here and they give the example of a breast cancer drug. It's called TDM1 and it works by attaching to the surface of tumor cells. But in order to do that, you have to have lots of receptors on the surface of the cells and not everybody has those. So if they can test you for the mutation that causes or dictates, you know, the number of receptors you have, then they can say, oh, we're not going to give you this one because it's not going to do what it's supposed to do, but it could still make you sick or have some side effect, you know?
And not to mention the fact that all of those kinds of therapeutics are extraordinarily expensive. So mm-hmm. if you're giving somebody a therapeutic that doesn't work because they're genetically not susceptible to having it work, then you know you're incurring an extraordinary cost for the patient.
Yes, that's another good point. So this could reduce healthcare costs over time because you're not, you know, throwing a dart at a dartboard, so to speak, and you're not working with probabilities. You have more specificity in that you're saying this person or this group of people is more likely to benefit. And there's a couple other examples. We don't have to go through them all, but cystic fibrosis, handful of other really serious conditions that we know a lot about in terms of how you would treat them and how apparently not to treat them, you know? So that's a big deal. One final thing that comes to mind, and I would love your thoughts on this. At some point in the future, you could probably say, you know, you're at risk for an adverse reaction to this vaccine, or this is going to work really well for you, or, you know, this subgroup of people is going to respond really well to this. So I see two benefits. The first is that you could target the efficacy of vaccines, which is really cool. But then yep. you could sort of, you know, on the front end, you could say, we don't have to worry about VAERS reports because we're not going to give this to these people, right?
It's people, so, yes. We're going to check what their genetic makeup is to see if they're prone to these adverse outcomes. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Right. So Steve Kirsch and all his friends, they're going to have to go back to, you know, picking peaches and changing tires, like get real jobs. but it's just great. I mean, it obviously, like so many technologies to talk about, this probably has ways to go. there's more genes to discover. There's more details. You probably need better studies and so forth. But it's nonetheless, it's very good.
It's news. Pretty cool science.
Yes. It's just fun to read about. This is the stuff that really got me interested in these different topics. All way back in the day, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, how did you figure that out? You know, it's amazing. Right.
There's smart people in the world. Really smart people.
Yes. Very smart people. Far smarter than I am. Okay. Let's move on to our final story. This is a gentleman named Marcel Bruins, writing for European Seed originally, and GLP republished this. It's called Social Media Amplifies Misinformation. Modern pesticides are not the driver of insect declines, and they are not poisoning us. This is a great one. I think he goes over three things. So he talks about the fact that pesticides really aren't wiping out insects. He talks about the fact that natural pesticides aren't better than synthetic pesticides. I hate that word. And then the idea that any pesticides are poisoning our food. So let's just bat these back and forth. I'm really curious. Your thoughts on this first one, pesticides kill insects. And he says, no, there's lots of things that affect insects, populations, and so forth. What do you think about this?
Well, yeah, it's important to say that pesticide is a umbrella term for a whole different categories of chemicals, right? So insecticides control insects, mm-hmm. like lice and fleas and ticks and insects that carry diseases to crops and harm food security, like locusts and a variety of other things like that. Then herbicides control toxic weeds that can get into your food supply. And I think we talked about Datura in the past, where you can have, if people get exposed to Datura in their food, they can wind up having what we call an anticholinergic toxidrome, where they have this wild psychomotor agitation, vivid hallucinations. They strip off all of their clothes and run around naked for 3 days and have seizures. And I'm not kidding, it's 3 days. Seizures and strokes and heat stroke and all sorts of things. So this is, you don't want those things in your food supply, because that's a problem, right? So herbicides control Datura, and Datura is contaminated. There was a big outbreak in Martinique a couple years ago where people had contaminated flour with Datura residues, and 35 people showed up at the hospital like that all at one time, wildly hallucinating and running all over the place. And France had to recall its green beans, I want to say maybe in 2019 too, because it was contaminated with Datura. So people are actually testing, regulatory agencies test for certain toxic weeds residues in your food supply to make sure that they don't have it, just like they test for pesticides. Yeah. So herbicides control that kind of thing. They also, incidentally, speaking of fires earlier, they control invasive weeds that are involved, like Arundo donax, which we talked about, which are very important kindling for wildfire in California. So herbicides control that too. And then you've got fungicides that control fungal infections. So for people, fungal infections tend to be a little bit minor. They tend to be skin infections, athlete's foot, that kind of thing, ringworm, unless you're immunosuppressed. And if you're immunosuppressed, then you can get some pretty significant fungal infections. But by and large, people don't have quite as big of a problem with fungal infections as plants do. Plants get bad fungal infections. And it's interesting because insects will carry fungi that are harbored in weeds from the weeds to the crops. And then when they eat the crop, they damage the crop, and then fungi proliferate and make mycotoxins like aflatoxin, which is the next most potent toxin to mankind after botulinum toxin. And if you have, so there are estimates that mycotoxins affect huge numbers of a huge swath of the crops in sub-Saharan Africa, because there's not a real good way to control these fungal infections. And they are associated, so chronic aflatoxin exposure is thought to contribute to a disease called kwashiorkor in children, and that's protein calorie malnutrition. And when you look at these kids, they look like they have liver failure. And acute aflatoxicosis actually causes a liver failure. So you want to have pretty significant, and aflatoxin is also a potent carcinogen. So trace amounts of aflatoxin in your food can actually cause liver cancer, and can in big doses and big exposures, they can cause fulminant hepatitis and kill people. And so there have been outbreaks of that recently. Actually, it's in 2004 in Kenya, big outbreak. So you want to have these classes of chemistry to protect you from insects that carry diseases and crops from insects that carry diseases, and you from toxic weeds, and you from fungal infections and crops from fungal infections that can actually hurt you more, having trace amounts of those. So yes, you can. Insecticides can kill insects, but these insecticides are often, used judiciously. They're not sprayed everywhere. You use it, there's a regulation as to where and how they're sprayed. The insecticides that are out there now have a toxicity profile that's very different than some of the older insecticides that you hear about. And so pyrethroids, for example, are synthetic chrysanthemum dust or spray or whatever. So it was noted for centuries, actually back to 400 BC, the Persians discovered that certain chrysanthemums had insecticidal properties. And they sold a powder called Persian powder of these chrysanthemums, because one of the leading causes of death in the military turns out to be insect-borne illness rather than war wounds. Mm. And it's interesting, if you look at when Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812, he went in with 400,000 troops and came out with less than 4,000. And about 15, 20 years ago, conventional wisdom is that they all died of the cold, right? Because they invaded Russia too late. They invaded Russia in June. And yes, some of them got stuck in the winter, but about 15, 20 years ago, they came across a mass grave in Lithuania while they were doing an excavation of his soldiers. And they realized that his soldiers had died of typhus, which is a louse-borne disease. And so armies would carry chrysanthemum powder to prevent these huge die-offs of soldiers. Wow. For that. So yes, insecticides kill insects, but the way they're applied is regulated. Mm-hmm. The residues are tested. The residues that are allowed on crops that you get to are too low to cause you any harm. Mm-hmm. And farmers aren't just spraying insecticide willy-nilly. They're very targeted. And, you can design crops like GMOs so organic farmers use something called BT. So Rachel Carson, when she was writing her book, Silent Spring, because she was very concerned and rightly concerned about the off-target effects of DDT and killing too many insects with DDT, she recommended that organic farmers, or that all farmers, use a chemical that comes from a bacterium that's totally innocuous people, right? It's called Bacillus thuringiensis, and it makes a protein that's very targeted to specific crop insects. And to this day, organic farmers spray BT on their crops, right? And that decreases the amount of insects that are actually eating that crop, and it spares beneficial insects, right? Well, where companies got smart is they discovered the gene in the bacterium that makes that chemical, and they put it in the crop. And now you don't need insecticides on your crop. So if you use GMO technology, you can actually decrease the need for insecticide. And to this day, organic farmers spray BT on top of their crops. And you can tailor BT to specific crop pests too. Yeah. So you can keep your beneficials, ladybugs and butterflies and things like that, and tailor it to the specific crop pests. So you decrease the need for other chemistries when you use that technology. And the other thing that GMOs do is since the insects aren't eating the crop, they are less likely to transmit fungal infections to the crop. And then you decrease your mycotoxin. So you have less need for fungicide too when you use GMO technology. So you don't have aflatoxin. You don't have, you know, a variety of other toxins that affect, mycotoxins that affect crops, and you decrease your insect impact.
Yes. That's such a great primer on everything pesticide. I really hope people listen to that and take notes, because that contained so much of what you need to know when you read news stories about pesticides. And also, if you don't want to have seizures while being naked and getting cancer, I mean, what else? You know, it's a very evocative example. Thank you for that. Let's go back to this point about regulation and protecting insects, just to the extent of how far this goes. So just for example, I had a pest control guy come to my house yesterday. Mm-hmm. They come every few months, and they always ask, you know, what issues are you having? And I said, well, we have ground nesting wasps that in the summer like to take up shop in our lawn. And I have a toddler that runs around. This is not going to stand, right? I have to get these bugs out of my lawn.
Yeah.
So I told him, I was like, this is my primary concern. Can you take care of that? He said, absolutely. But we are not allowed to spray if there are weeds in your lawn, because there are flowering weeds and there are bees that pollinate the weeds in your lawn. So if you have weeds, I cannot spray. And my only point in that is to say that's the extent to which pesticide companies and companies that use pesticides and regulators look at, right? To the point that in my backyard, in my tiny little backyard, right, they're not going to spray to get rid of wasps because there might be some honeybees or some. Yeah. Yeah. So they're very thoroughly regulated, right? There's some places you're just not allowed to use certain pesticides certain times a year because of temperature inversions and wind and so forth. They're very carefully regulated. Oh, and of course, with like neonicotinoids, which I believe replaced pyrethroids pretty significantly.
They did, but it's pyrethroids are still widely used. Yeah.
Okay. So neonicotinoids, for those of you unaware, they're typically applied as powdered seed coatings. So you might see corn or soy that looks blue or gold or like some weird color. That's because it's been coated with a neonicotinoid, and it's a systemic insecticide. So you plant the seeds, they're covered, and as the plant grows, it's got a little bit of this chemical all throughout it. So when the bugs bite it, they die. But the pollinating insects like bees and so forth, they don't do that. So they're not at risk, and a lot of them are not flowering plants.
Yep.
So in other words, right, the technology gets better and people go, you know, let's not kill non-target insects because there's value. And of course, we're just not evil, you know. So yeah,
that's right.
It's really important. Okay, let's not belabor this too much. So there's pesticides can be used safely. Insects are not going to be wiped out if you, you know, spray glyphosate or whatever.
Yeah.
And again, we sort of covered this already, but natural is not healthier, right? There's this big taboo around synthetic chemicals. All that means is you synthesize two chemicals together and you get a third one. And that's, you know, pyrethrins are natural, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Pyrethroids are the synthetic version, but they work essentially the same way. And I think they're actually a little bit safer than the...
And they actually are a little bit less allergenic, right? Okay. And they also are stabilized in light. So you actually have it, they're more effective because they don't break down in light so much. Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So, in other words, and this is his point, is that, you know, there are a lot of pesticides, I believe you mentioned, right? A lot of these are natural, like nicotine is a great example, but yeah, there's lots of different pesticides that are produced by plants. Like, where did you think we got the idea for these chemicals, right? Because the plants...
Exactly. Plants can't run away from you.
Right.
Right? So they make their own chemistries, their own natural chemistries. And we have sort of been able to figure out what those chemistries are and use them as a template, Mother Nature as a template to develop lots of different insecticides and herbicides and things like that. So, yeah.
There was one, we'll have to talk about this next week, or maybe you know, but you told me about an herbicide one time that like it was being developed for an entirely different purpose. And then someone spilled it on the grass one time, like, hey, this kills weeds. I forget which one it was. We'll have to revisit that.
That paraquat.
That's right. What they were using it for industrial.
It was a color indicator. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it burned plants. Yeah.
That's hilarious, right? So there you go, right? It's just these kind of accidental science experiments that you learn stuff from. But in any case, yeah, natural is not better. And then the final one he talks about is pesticides poisoning our food. Again, you have lots of insight here. I'll just say as we have, they're very carefully regulated. They dose rats with them. They find out, like, at what point does the rat, like, twitch its neck? Okay, all right, set it 10 or 1,000 times lower than that, and then that's the amount that farmers are allowed to spray.
But so, yeah, they have maximum residue level that they can spray, and that is an enforceable thing, and it's actually tested. But what the maximum residue level does not mean that there's a safety risk if you exceed it. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that you're going to be poisoned by the crop if you exceed that maximum residue level. That's a regulatory level that determines whether or not you can actually sell your crop, right? And that is the maximum dose that you can have on there. Now, what they do to establish the level that you actually will have exposure to is they will have the MRL for one crop, and then they will look at all of the other places you can get exposed to these pesticides. And so air, water, fruits, vegetables, all that kind of stuff like that. And they will come up with a maximum exposure limit, right? Mm-hmm. And that they'll include kids in there and sensitive populations in there. And that maximum exposure limit that you can get from all those roots is orders of magnitude smaller than the allowable daily intake, which is the non-toxic dose in animals with a safety factor of 100 or 1,000 built in. So by default, what you are eating is thousands of times lower than the non-toxic dose in animals that's established by all the safety studies. You can't get to the allowable daily intake. You would have to eat hundreds of bowls of oatmeal every day, all day long, till you were 70, and you would die from oatmeal poisoning before you ever got to that dose.
Yeah.
So it's all very well tested and very well regulated.
Yeah. Your stomach would explode. You'd get diabetes from all the strawberries before you die from pesticide toxicity. Let me recommend Dr. Carl Winter's work. He's retired now, but he was at UC Davis for many years. He's written some very interesting papers. They're very readable too. He wrote one where he compared Environmental Working Group's methodology on the Dirty Dozen to the processes that EPA has put in place and that pesticide companies have to comply with. And it's absurd. I mean, they know everything. They know, like, at what point the chemical has a biological effect. They know at what point it causes a harmful effect. They know at which point it'll kill the animals that it's being tested on. Yep. They compare that then to the amount of pesticide that farmers are using. I mean, they know everything about this, and it's really useful to understand that. And it drives me nuts to talk about this. I love talking about it, but it also makes me mad as a parent, because what groups like EWG will do, they will discard all of the research that's been done and all of the regulatory measures that are in place. They will lobby a member of Congress to write a piece of legislation, and they'll call it, you know, Save Children from Poisons Act 2023 or whatever. Then they will get it into Congress. It doesn't have to pass. It just has to get into the legislative process. And then they write a stupid paper like the one we talked about earlier, and they put out a press release, and they tell the media, this is the level that we think is protective. Our experts say this is protective of children's health. Now, never mind, they have a single toxicologist on staff. Everyone else is a lawyer, okay?
Yes, right.
Right. So in other words, and I don't mean to ramble here, the EPA has very tight standards in place. You can go look up everything. You can go look up all the test results. It's all free. If you're having trouble sleeping, check it out. There's a handbook of pesticide registration. I'm not kidding. It's like 25 chapters. You'll pass out. I promise. It's better than Ambien or whatever you take. But in any case, the point is that they just propose this standard. It's in a piece of legislation, and they say the government's not doing enough, and that's why we propose this legislation. And meanwhile, it's like a limit that's so low, you can't even detect it with the tools that we have.
Right.
It's absurd. So your food's safe. That's all I got.
Yes, we have the most abundant and safe food supply in the history of humanity. Mm-hmm. And partially because we have access to these chemistries, which make our food abundant and healthy. And so these things are very well regulated around the world. People, you know, can't trade them if their levels are too high.
Yeah.
And they protect you from other chemicals in the food supply that you don't want. So they protect you from datura, the chemicals that make you hallucinate, and they protect you from, and don't try that at home, because that's not like you know, the new, there's a new huge kind of focus on LSD and magic mushrooms being good for you. Don't try this one.
Yeah.
This one's a bad one. But it protects you from harmful substances in your food.
Yeah, it's really good. One final thing, I have all these facts floating around my head. The FDA tests the food that you eat. Like, they go and they test the actual stuff that you eat. The USDA tests the raw agricultural ingredients. They test imports of those things. The EPA is also involved. Like, it's so carefully studied because nobody wants to be blamed for children dying from dangerous food. No one wants that. Nobody wants that.
We all have kids that eat this food too. Right? So we have children and we don't want to hurt our children. And so that's exactly right.
Really good stuff. Thank you, as always, Dr. Liza Dunn, for filling in the science for folks here. I'm really glad that that we're doing this. I hope people are getting some insights here. We will be back next week for episode 219. You are at Dr. Liza MD on Twitter.
Yes.
Okay. Follow her. Follow me at Cam J English. We'd love to interact with you guys. Follow Genetic Literacy Project. They are at Genetic Literacy on Twitter. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
See you next time. Bye-bye.